No genuine teacher can effect the final self-overcoming for the student. He must bring it about by his own free choice and by his own firm effort. But the constructive criticism of such a teacher is usually illuminating, whilst his personal presence is always inspiring. This introspective dive into the depths of the aspirant's character and capacity is a venture which must be coolly and boldly made. It will inevitably meet with innate resistances, instinctive oppositions and emotional impediments which seek to check his descent. These arise naturally out of inborn tendencies as well as environment, education or circumstances. They are mostly masked weaknesses or psychological repressions. Nevertheless, as he becomes aware of them by calm self-criticism he should find in their very presence, if he is philosophically minded, a special incentive to correct them and secure right adjustment to life. This demands great intellectual honesty in refusing to evade realities and greater intellectual courage in overcoming obscurantism. It is therefore a task for a mental hero who is not ashamed to learn that he needs altering and not afraid to contribute voluntarily to such a reform. It is an inner metabolistic process which gives temporary pain but leads to permanent health. And this is the only way in which he can fit himself for the mastery of the hidden philosophy. To persuade people to challenge or change their old habits of thinking is immensely hard, for human nature is conservative at heart. And these old habits stubbornly reassert themselves at every opportunity. Yet if a man finds that these psychological qualifications seem far beyond his reach, and this standard of intellectual conduct far too exalted, he need not be mortified. The remarkable clinical results achieved by psychotherapeutic treatment point the way to undreamed of powers of self-improvement which lie latent in the human mind. None of us has reached the limit of his capacity. Insight always accumulates when we search for new horizons. Many a man might become a philosopher if he would but bestir himself, if he would pay the price in persistent unrelenting effort to break the spell of old fallacies, and if he would take firm hold of a living transforming faith in his own progressive possibilities. Years ago we used to think that every man was born with a set character, a fixed degree of ability, and a limited amount of mental power and that he could never exceed these limits. Today the penetrating analysis of psychology has banished the myth of the last phrase into the limbo where it deserves to remain. Just as the power of physical culture is nowadays universally acknowledged to be a definite one, just as we know that our muscles can be made stronger and the blood circulation quickened by daily exercise, so we know now that our mental ability and natural characteristics can be developed along precise lines, if we set about the task in the right way. A 10,000-mile journey starts with the first step, says a Chinese proverb. No wise man will despair, therefore, over the perplexities and difficulties of studying this philosophy. Nobody has really failed until he has given up. Why should we not today do what other men intend to do tomorrow? Or, to alter Milton's line, they are not served to only stand and wait. We may remake our mentality if we will. For the theories of psychology and the actualities of experience clearly exhibit the fact that the capacity of the mind is extraordinarily flexible and expansive. It can grow beyond recognition when patient effort to understand the apparently incomprehensible is conjoined with hope, which is the last of human possessions, as wisdom is the best. Therefore we must ungrudgingly discipline ourselves mentally and mold ourselves ethically to arouse the right attitude for the arduous journey which lies before us. This is our preliminary step. If this book presents the world with a doctrine which demands an unusual amount of sustained attention merely to follow it, which requires an intensity of concentrated thought on the part of its students such as few seem to possess, and which holds up an ideal of selflessness that will seem to most men as quite unattainable. The reply in defense may be taken from Thoreau that we are not the less to aim at the summits, though the multitude does not ascend them. Nor does this mean that we are required to possess the required characteristics to perfection, it means that we are to make an inner exertion to develop them to an extent sufficient to enable us to grasp the elementary and earlier principles of philosophy at least, and to keep the seven qualifications ever before us as personal ideals. Thus Ch's narrow cheek of intellectual light may grow and grow until it becomes a broad beam, illuminating much that was formerly indistinct. A humble beginning may suffice to start with, for by the time we have mastered more of these principles we will have experienced Jilu, the subtle charm and extraordinary fascination which lie in the soul, deeply hidden behind philosophy's forbidding face. We shall then yield willingly to its demand upon us for further self-improvement in such qualifications, even though we may realize that their fuller acquisition will not be a swift matter nor a simple one. We shall thus unfold the characteristics stage by stage, not all at once. Most of us begin as sinners, we may only hope to end one day as sages. But there is an immense difference between the man who wallows contentedly in his sins and the man who lifts himself up dissatisfied and discontented after every occasion of sinning. The first is bogged and aimless, whereas the second is not only moving but possesses right direction. For the pure joy of ennobling character, sharpening intelligence and gaining strength as we proceed is one of the uncounted profits of philosophy. A mere glimpse at the qualities needed for such a chastening study will prove that they can be no mere polish to show off a man's intellect nor even a cultural ornament. They demand much from a man, but in the end they give more, for they possess plenty of bearing on this business of making both material livelihood and eternal life. They lead to a balanced understanding of the whole of life, not for theoretical display but for effective and sensible action. It has already been shown that the practical justification of religion is its advocacy of the good life. It shall later be shown that the practical justification of philosophy is its advocacy of the best life. Even if this study does nothing more, the practical and psychological aims it sets before us will have laid the firm mental and moral foundation for an exceptional personality, who is sure sooner or later to be marked out for superiority in one sphere or another. It will become a safe guide to proper action and a satisfaction of the purest and most exalted feelings. We shall undergo a profound transformation for the better of attitude, outlook and habits. Thus those sacrificial hours which are given to philosophic discipline or study are not given in vain. The deity whom we thus worship well rewards its faithful devotees. It would be easy for the inexperienced to undervalue the necessity of these seven psychological qualifications. But the striving philosopher knows that they are his most precious attributes. With them he is rendered ready for enlightenment and may hope to realize life's supreme goal, but without them, never. The truth above all. The first characteristic is none other than a strong yearning to find truth. The aspirant must learn how to go down on his knees for freedom from ignorance. No Asiatic sage of olden days would even touch on the alphabet of philosophy to any inquirer if he noticed that this yearning was absent or extremely feeble. One cannot set a water-sodden woodpile ablaze until it is somewhat dry, neither can any honest teacher take a satisfied worldling, to whom the world needs no questioning and looks good enough as it is, and take his mind to the higher regions of being. This yearning is a higher octave of the same deep-felt longing to get at the hidden heart of life which mystics call the manifestation of grace. Only here it rises from compelling emotion to calm thought as it takes a more advanced form and demands ultimate truth rather than temporary satisfaction. Not many are born with such an attribute of loving truth for its own sake, for ordinarily the mind does not want to exert itself to find it. Those others who acquire it later in life usually do so out of the depths of agonized suffering, tragic loss or disappointment with religion or mysticism. It may also arise from personal contact with a genuine sage, when the outward demonstration of its benefits, especially in critical times, may become both plainly apparent and mentally attractive. The desire for truth really means the desire to get rid of ignorance. No truly thoughtful man can rest satisfied like a merely sensual animal, but after initial wonder or doubt about the cosmic spectacle must at some time or other strive to tear aside the veil that hides life's meaning. He must be bent on the removal of this ignorance. If he dogmatizes that truth is unattainable, he thereby becomes unqualified. Let him strive first, and never desist from such striving, if he wishes to dogmatize correctly on this point. And whoever is merely or momentarily curious likewise renders himself unfit, for he too will soon fall by the wayside. Wisdom must win a man as her ardent disciple or not at all. He is best fitted for philosophy who is attracted to it by a burning passion for truth rather than by an ascetic repugnance to the world. Truth demands a deep devotion before revealment. Very few want it so strongly. Most men and women may be interested in it as a hobby or for polite intellectual discussion, but stop short at permitting it to tincture their lives. Therefore they act hoodwinked, and given shoddy substitutes, because just as in everyday transactions for material things they get only what they pay for. They are soon tested on this quest, anyhow. Those who are unconsciously insincere or whose motives are quite mediocre or whose aims are limited will let their love of lesser but more tangible things outweigh their love of intangible truth. For they will be brought to consider deeply and deliberately whether by time or by teacher not only if they want the highest truth loo but also if they want it irrespective of its unpleasantness or pleasantness. The right kind of seeker will pursue it to the end and then accept it whatever its taste, be it like poison or like nectar, for he has understood the implication and felt the force of Bacon's saying that no pleasure is comparable to the standing upon the vantage ground of truth. Whoever yearns to hear the veiled goddess's call and to follow her wherever she be found, whether in unfamiliar lands or in unfamiliar thoughts, becomes her beloved votary. Hold on and hope on. But the goddess will not walk in like an apparition to visit him, he must go in restless search of her. It will be quite natural therefore for anyone who feels such a strong truthward yearning to strive in consequence to possess the second qualification, which is an enduring determination to take up the quest of truth and persevere, come what may, until the goal is reached. The quest is inevitably a long and steep hill which must be climbed with struggle and effort, rather than a flat road where progress is easy and predictable. This single factor of unabated endurance amid all the perplexity and darkness which envelop the aspirant is most essential if he is not to tire in discouragement and forego the quest. It is essential because it gives him the propulsive force which he needs to drive him onwards through all difficulties, across all disadvantages and against all obstacles, rendering him strong enough indeed to carry through to the bitter end. Even he who does feel the truth yearning must guard it well, for he is swimming against the stream of superficial present-day environments, a hard task but a manageable one, because whoever is really in earnest receives an undaunted courage born of despair. Defeatist moods of mind and heart will inevitably blow over him and go, but the determination to carry on with the quest must remain. Mental chameleons who change the color of their goal with every year cannot suit this path. The seeker must be patient enough to endure steadfastly both trials and temptations, troubles and joys, and yet remain as patiently determined as before. Tests and ordeals will beset his whole worldly path and constantly assail his mind. Let us return to our analogy of an explorer and say that he has set out to cross northern Africa from coast to coast. If he were to stop short at any point of his journey and turn back because of lack of water or hostile environment or attacks by sandflies, snakes and mosquitoes, he would never reach the other coast. The seeker after truth must be no less keen within his own sphere of intellectual exploration and refuse to turn aside from pressing onward in his settled direction. He must know how to continue with studies that yield no immediate fruit and how to wait for the favored moment of illumination. None of us is entirely our own master and all must await the proper time, the destined hour of higher comprehension, and yet we must not slacken our work whilst waiting. Time is thus a factor which must be allowed for. Colonel Lindbergh's leap across the Atlantic was in its day a feat which was sung to the skies in which he flew. But it came only after he had already practiced 7,000 lesser trips. The glamour of philosophic achievement gives vivid color to a historic name, but beneath the story of success runs an unseen river of persistent and patient day-by-day toil. The revelation of truth must grow little by little within oneself as it draws the mind to a gradual transfiguration, albeit its final realization may occur with startling suddenness. We must fight our own weakness of purpose. The real struggle in life is the struggle of man against himself. It is the one which fewest enter because it asks so much from him. yet it is the only one which is really worthwhile. Nothing great or grand can be obtained by mere wanting. To get, one must be prepared to give oneself. There was once a wandering teacher in Galilee who noticed the common inclination to feebleness in his own followers. He had to tell them, "Those that do my words shall know my doctrine." The determined mind achieves most. When the pressure valve on a steam boiler begins to rise, a greater volume of energy begins to come out of the engine. When the same wires which carried a feeble current of electricity suddenly begin to carry a high voltage, results improve as quickly. These things are parables which man should heed. Finally, philosophic determination to ascertain what is truth refuses to confuse defeat with failure. From the first it draws the dividends of warning or wisdom, but the second it never acknowledges. Think. The third required characteristic is thinking power, an intelligence sufficiently vigorous to weigh the relative importance of things or validity of statements correctly and not merely conventionally. Philosophy demands perspective. It seeks to see things as they really are. This implies a certain mental alertness which is awake to the trite but true saying that things are not always what they appear to be. The false often appears or is made to appear as the true. Reasoning should be so independent that it produces a stubborn refusal to accept any opinion merely because everyone else holds it. The herd sinks in the flood of the opinions and theories of others because it is held mentally by erroneous beliefs, seeming realities and misleading appearances, but the thinker stands firm. The way out from this bondage is right reflection, deep analysis and constant inquiry, all combined in quest of truth. This study involves much new and not at all easy thinking. Our generation may not assimilate much of it, but the pioneer minds certainly can. An intense intelligence is required. We must think, we must act, not for ourselves but for truth. Such cultivation of rational insight will facilitate the understanding of the philosophy. Nor is this all the implication. Equally important is the keen capacity to distinguish what is ephemeral from what is eternal. The things of a day from the things of a lifetime. The passing show of material existence from the relatively more permanent mental factors. It might be called the sixth sense, which knows what is genuinely fundamental in the game of living. It should so act that it leads to a constant exercise of discernment between those values which are enduring and those which are merely temporary. And it should so love strict fact rather than pleasant fancy that the determination to discriminate the real from the illusory, which is most essential throughout the study and practice of philosophy, gradually becomes uppermost. Philosophy cannot become intelligible without much mental effort. It is hard to follow, so hard that the effort is often like trying to walk on a logical tightrope without losing balance, and those who are unable or unwilling to put the effort forth will necessarily find parts of this book a puzzle, no matter how plain its language. The intellectually timid and the mentally weak often excuse themselves by saying that such inquiries are unnecessary. This is because they do not know the place of truthful thought in life. Consequently, they do not understand that to stimulate thought is no less needed than to inform it. To play with a few problems in order to be able to air some witty remarks to admiring society does not make anyone a philosopher. He alone who will think matters out to their final end, who will hunt every question down to its central issue and not hesitate at any point because he comes counter to a notion held by all other men, who will ruthlessly apply the conclusion he makes to the life he leads, is worthy of the name of truth seeker. Whoever is unwilling to examine a tenet in order to find out whether it be true or not, merely because its alien face is completely unfamiliar, has no right to receive truth. And whoever is deterred from inquiring into a doctrine because it is not held within his own country or among his own people, but hails from another land and from people of another complexion, is equally unworthy of this priceless gift. Reason knows no geographical frontiers. In this sphere of philosophical research, the introduction of political bias or racial prejudice against tenet or teacher is utterly fatal to success. The ordinary man is impatient of sustained reflection and is governed by immediate impressions. He jumps too quickly to conclusions, often basing them on superficial and misleading appearances. Thus he remains bound by ignorance. This weakness is a defect which can be overcome by discipline. Such a mind needs to deepen and sharpen its own character, and train itself into habits of travel beneath surfaces. No mind which refuses to undergo such strengthening and training is capable of the undertaking involved in philosophy. The quest of what is, sharpness of understanding is needed to take away all those things which are not true, all illusions, and to clear away confusions. Moreover, its need will also become apparent when in the further volume we shall study the significance of sleep and dream. The ultimate ideal is a mind as keen as a Toledo sword blade, that the steely thrust of its thought may effectively pierce delusions and fancies, sentiments and superstitions. The most cherished and cheerful notions may have to vanish when dissected by such a keen blade, for it will be discovered as this study unfolds, that nearly all men harbor plenty of illusions merely because the movement of their mind is faulty and tardy, and because its edge is blunt. Inner detachment. When the mind has thus been sharpened, it will be better predisposed to unfold the fourth characteristic. This is a settled attitude of inner detachment from both the unpleasant episodes and pleasant attractions which constitute the nadir and zenith of mundane living. Whatever misfortune the turning wheel of destiny may bring to the forefront of the student's life, he must cultivate a hidden indifference, and whatever enjoyment or desires rule the hour, he should not be so strongly attached to them that he cannot let them quickly go if need be. If he wants to secure a philosophic perspective, he must stand on the ground of such indifference, because his attachments create mental far-backslash-auritism and thus prevent his reaching a fair impartial attitude when weighing evidence, pursuing inquiries or delivering judgment. Moreover, such a qualification is needed so that the seeker may not be drawn aside from his quest by temporary allurements. For were he so attached to the ordinary experience of the world that it meant everything to him, there would not exist any cause for embarking on this philosophic quest. An intelligence which is not stupefied by social convention, personal status, inordinate ambition, hilarious hedonism or unsatisfied desires cannot help discerning that life upon this rotating globe is a changing flux of both favorable and unfavorable events from which none are exempt. And if this same intelligence is sufficiently sharp, it will also perceive that everything, including itself, is perishable, everything is evanescent. All worldly attractions, all earthly possessions, all human relationships, all sensual pleasures as well as their objects may die or disappear tomorrow. Therefore, the philosophic student is required to cultivate a correct attitude towards their seductive glamour, which is to be neither one of blind infatuation nor of total repulsion. He must assign an accurate value to this fitful panorama of the passing days if he is not to deceive himself. When he sees that everything is relative and everyone is transient, he will understand that they can yield only a relative and transient happiness to him at the best. He must understand that he is not safe if he regards what is fleeting as the end-all and be-all of his incarnation. He must therefore become serious enough to use his intelligence in the uncommon direction of seeking for something that does not die and does not pass away. Whether such a thing can be found or not is a different matter. But the quest of philosophy is for a reality which is enduring and an absolute truth which lies beyond mere human opinion. But not only does he need his intelligence to see all this, but he also needs his courage to admit it. If he can travel so far, and few can, he is then prepared to take up the attitude advocated here, a certain stoic detachment from the fluctuations of individual fate and an ascetic equanimity towards pleasure. There are other minds, however, which may not be so sharp as to see the need of such an attitude, and yet they will arrive at it all the same, as the outcome of certain experiences through which they have passed. In them it arises out of great suffering, bitter loss, sudden shock, unsuccessful striving or profound danger. Such persons are often quite rich in earthly experience. When they are bored with paying court to the casual and leaving the fundamental far behind, when they are tired of fretting through the dark years and philandering through the bright ones, they unconsciously form this philosophic characteristic for themselves. The abrasions to women's hearts caused by unkind or unfaithful men, no less than the shadowed emptiness which fickle women bring into the hearts of infatuated men, may eventually cause this qualification to appear T. Thus intense suffering injects some indifference towards life into human blood. The worldwide sorrows and sufferings which have bitterly wounded our century have provided some lesser initiation into such an attitude. When people observe that the existence of their possessions, properties and persons is no longer secure, but may disappear on the morrow, when they have passed through the anguish of losing the substance of their wealth or the presence of beloved relatives, they tend to lose something of their attachment to worldly life. They realize how transient and unstable it is, and the days of dreadful chaos and continued insecurity become less attractive in their eyes. Thus sorrow leads to understanding. Every tear becomes a tutor. It would be easy for the nature of such a quality to be misunderstood by those who have never felt it or have never seen it in action, or having seen it manifested theoretically taken it to be what it is not. It does not imply ascetic running away from human life, nor turning away from personal activity, nor even estrangement from common enjoyments, but something quite different. A mere temporary disgust due to passing affliction will not suffice. Something profounder is needed, a veritable casting off of invisible chains. Indeed, he who possesses it may outwardly partake of all the same routine existence of family obligations, work and pleasure as others, but deep down in his heart he will evaluate it at its true worth as being transitory and unabiding. This characteristic need not divorce him from practical and personal life. He will carry out all their requirements to the letter, and his external relationships may even exist as before, but he will form a different estimate of them from the common one. He may act in the same way as others, but will not get lost in his action. He may appreciate the delight of comfortable environments and other attractions, and he may know how to enjoy them no less than others. Nevertheless, he does not pin his hopes for happiness entirely to such a basis, for he has a clear sense of the transitory nature of all things. In this sense only may it be said that he abstains mentally. Nor does this characteristic mean a weakening of worldly capacities. It is to be interpreted correctly only when its emphasis is placed in the background of the mind rather than the forefront. The man will be as firm and matter-of-fact in his practical dealings as any business executive, but duty will motivate him more than desire. If there is no room here for a facile optimism about life, neither is the place for gloomy pessimism. The goal is too grand for that. The ordinary person may mask his bitter disappointment or secret suffering behind a polite smile or a pungent cynicism, but the philosopher needs no such mask, and even if he has a deeply serious purpose in life, he knows that he can be serious without being solemn. He may still like to laugh. He will always hope that the time will never come when he shall be unable to laugh at himself. But should such an unfortunate mishap befall him, if he is a true philosopher, he will ask his friends but one favor: to wrap him up neatly in a winding shroud and bear him away quickly to the nearest crematorium! For he would rather not afflict the world with one who thinks so highly of self that he has forgotten that his present birth is but one out of millions, and who thinks so meanly of reality that he cannot play with his surface life as cheerfully as a child plays with hoop and stick. And if in his search after truth by the power of strict reasoning he slay all the poetry of his soul, neglect and lose all the fine nuances of feeling which come to him through the arts and nature, he is undone. If it brings him to the point where a forest becomes a collection of so many thousand trees and nothing more, nothing of mellow peace and classic beauty, he is undone. If he cannot linger for a few minutes every evening to pause amid his business and watch the play of lovely colors as the sun dies, he is also undone. Possessed for accurate measurement by the logical mind need not displace the appreciation of charm and atmosphere by the sensitive heart. There is plenty of room in life for both. Thus it is both possible and preferable that the philosophic insight which produces detachment should rest alongside the full growth of human culture and human activity. Not the loss of passion or a maimed zest for life is desirable so much as the cultivation of profound detachment deep within those moments of passion or zest. Concentration, calmness and reverie. The need of gaining the fifth characteristic has already been mentioned in an earlier chapter. This consists of ability to practice the technique of meditation. The general aspects of this technique have been fully dealt with in the writer's other books, and here it will suffice to note only 3 points which the practitioner needs to emphasize, especially if he is also pursuing the philosophic quest. He has here no concern with the other consequences of yoga. Indeed, occult experiences, extraordinary visions and similar abnormal happenings will only hinder his progress in philosophy if he pays them undue attention. They have no importance here, however encouraging they often are on the mystic path.